It's not new information for Alaskans that too much trouble is caused by the abuse of alcohol here. Why is that? And how early do Alaskans start drinking and start getting into trouble because of it? I'm Lori Townsend. Today on Talk of Alaska, we're discussing young Alaskans and when they start to go off the road with alcohol and drugs. A new series of stories called The Blind Spot, produced by KSKA reporters Zachariah Hughes and Ann Hillman, look at the statistics the trouble young people get into and how they're helping themselves. Juveniles and substance abuse today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message sponsored by APU. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we are discussing youth and substance abuse. In the studio with me are Ann Hillman, KSKA reporter, and Zachariah Hughes, another KSKA reporter.
Good morning, Lori.
Good morning. Thank you for being here and talking about a very important topic, one that is certainly something that plagues Alaska and has for decades, unfortunately. We've stayed in the top tier in these dubious distinctions of alcohol and substance abuse and violence in our state. Not very cheery stuff, but there are some hopeful signs, and we're going to be discussing those today on the program. If you'd like to join us, you can call in from across the state, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255 in the Anchorage area. The local number is 550-8422. 550-8422, and you can email us. We're multi-platform now, talk@alaskapublic.org. So first, I'd like for you guys to sort of set the scene for us and tell us how it is that you got into this project in the first place. It started through a fellowship with the Alaska Press Club.
So back in January, Press Club, along with Rasmussen and Recover Alaska, were offering basically training to teach journalists how to look at numbers and how to use numbers in their reporting. But they wanted every group to focus on alcohol use in the state because it's a big issue, because it's something that we need to start having productive conversations about. And so we started talking to lots of different organizations about what kind of data sets are available and what kind of complete data sets are available. And we learned a lot of things about how they keep crime statistics. If adult crime statistics are complete when looking at alcohol and drug abuse, and they're not necessarily. And eventually we chose to look at data from the Department of Juvenile Justice.
Division of Juvenile Justice, yeah. And there were two reasons for that. One was they had better data that was available, and it was publicly accessible. DJJ has been a wonderful organization to work with because they also have a stake in making sure that there's accurate information reported. And to their tremendous credit, they have a lot of publicly available statistics on who comes in, from which parts of the state, during which years, under which charges. And for outsiders, it took a little bit of parsing to figure out, you know, what's the difference between an offense and a referral. You know, how do they classify nonviolent crime versus violent crime, assault, stuff like that. But we always had people that were willing to walk us through and explain stuff at every level of our inquiry from the very beginning all the way through. But the adult statistics just weren't quite in the same shape. There's a lot more reported on how adults, the criminal justice system, and substance abuse all intersect. But in terms of record keeping, being fairly new, the both of us, Ann and I, to data reporting and having felicity with a lot of the numbers to be able to find a compelling narrative, we just didn't have those skills. You know, we weren't able, and we're a pretty small newsroom. We couldn't establish, you know, a four-person desk or reporting team to start building data sets and cleaning it. This was new to us. And so it was a tremendous opportunity that this fellowship was giving reporters from across the state, and literally from Nome, Bethel, Southeast, Kodiak, Fairbanks, Anchorage. It really was like the statewide thing that brought reporters together for a week to say, okay, you guys know how to ask questions, you know how to navigate sources. What you don't know is how to, build a Google spreadsheet, feed that into a Torque Map program, and model across the state what some of this stuff means. And so that was kind of where it started. And being, radio reporters, we work a lot with voice and with anecdote and with personal story. And I don't want to say that's incompatible with these giant sets of anonymous data points and numbers, but a lot of our work was figuring out, okay, how do we take a Google spreadsheet with 2,000 cells in it and make that
radio.
Yeah, radio. How do we, our original plan was to just read off each cell, 21, 22, 47, 1991.
Yeah, sounds thrilling.
So, but actually we were pretty lucky in that the data set that we honed in on, especially because we're focusing on Anchorages, is pretty small. The Division of Juvenile Justice has a lot more data that they don't make public, and they have a lot more details that they don't make public. But with what we could work with, we were basically looking at the total number of juvenile offenses over time, so 2003 until 2014. And then we were looking at the subset of that, so which offenses are related to drug and alcohol use.
And let me ask a quick question here. Did you get some insight into, it's interesting to me that there's more data and it's cleaner to look at as it relates to juvenile offenses than adults.
That's not quite. So basically, the way that the FBI and other agencies report data for adults is they have what's called like a hierarchy of offenses. And so in the data sets that they provide out into the public, like whatever the most serious offense is that occurs, that's what they're going to report. And so it's harder when looking at sort of these larger data sets.
I see.
To really parse out the drug and alcohol. With this particular small set of data from DJJ, they do, with offenses, they do list all by charge type, and they don't, with referrals, it's by the most serious offense, which is often a crime against a person or property. With looking at just offenses, they'll highlight drug and alcohol offenses.
I misspoke, and I shouldn't say there was better data. For somebody that was as new as I was with these kind of fresh eyes looking at it, it was easier to understand lot of the DJJ data, and it was more straightforward.
And even talking to the statisticians over at DJJ, they're like, yeah, we know more information. Part of whether or not a drug or alcohol offense is attached to a different kind of offense is also depending on what the officer reports. And so, things like if you steal something, it's a pretty obvious offense. If you're drinking while you're stealing something, it's not always as obvious of an offense. And so they tend to know, but sometimes it depends a little bit on what the officers report, is what the statisticians were telling me.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to join our conversation today. We're talking about juvenile justice, substance abuse, when and how young people start to get into trouble, and what's being done to help them get back on track. And also locally, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. You ended up producing a 5-part series. How did you decide what to take from all of this body of data and hone it down into sort of 5 parts? And tell us about the 5 parts.
I think the real answer is we had deadlines and had to kind of make decisions about what was available. You know, I think every reporter when they get the chance to do substantive long form reporting wants to keep going, because the more you talk with people and the more you find out, the more you realize you have so much more to find out.
Sure.
And so the three stories that we told were, I don't like to use the word contingent, but they were very much kind of, these were who we talked to. We could have pursued it, but we just, we needed to make sure this aired. And they were really good talkers, and they were good stories. So we had that luxury going for us as well. I don't know if you want to say more about it.
Well, ultimately, so it's a 5-part series. We had to start with the data in part because of the fellowship, but also because that is, it's a jumping off point. And for many stories, data is a jumping off point. And so because the data was saying, all right, listen, overall juvenile offenses in Anchorage are going down, the number of drug and alcohol offenses are staying steady, like as a percentage, they're very, very small percent, but it's going up. So basically what that gave us to, got us to is, all right, why? Mm-hmm. Why is this number holding steady? And the thing is yeah, you can look at numbers, but people aren't going to connect to numbers.
Right.
Like you're going to connect to a personal experience. You're going to connect to the relationship between these two women. You're going to connect to like a teenager who's just looking for something to hold on to, a different path to go down, a support system. And so through that, yeah, we're going to jump into the personal stories and we're going to talk to the researchers who can give us a little bit of data, like information about solutions and whatnot. And ultimately, how we ended up with this is, yeah, sure, yes, drugs and alcohol are an issue in the state. They're an issue nationwide, but that doesn't have to continue that way. There's solutions that people are developing on their own and that agencies and organizations are coming up with. And so the idea behind the series wasn't just, all right, this is still a problem. It's, this is a problem, but we can solve this.
Well, let's talk, and I want to invite people that if you have a personal story you'd like to tell, if you'd like to join the conversation about perhaps how you went off the road and got back on it yourself, or what services are available that you know of that are working in your community, give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255, or locally 550-8422. Let's talk about the numbers themselves, because I think some people would be surprised to know that the actual percentages of kids who are drinking maybe aren't as high as people think they are.
So that goes, the best way and the most frequently way that's, that data is accumulated is through what's called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. And so this is a self-reported survey done for high school kids, not just in Alaska, but
is
throughout
it anonymous?
The U.S. It is.
Okay.
That doesn't necessarily mean people trust that it's anonymous.
Right, yes.
But yeah, so it's data that's been collected for well over a decade from the CDC. And so if you're looking at it, so just looking at the 2013 data, which is the most recently available, only 12.8% of high schoolers in Alaska say they've binge drunk on alcohol. So they've drunk more than five drinks at one time. So that's compared to the U.S. wide, 20% say. So basically flipping that around, nearly 78% of high schoolers in Alaska say they're not binge drinking.
Has that changed dramatically over the last couple of decades? What were the numbers 20 years ago compared to now?
So I only have the numbers from 10 years ago.
Okay.
But back
what were the numbers 10 years ago?
So back in 2003, high schoolers were reporting 26% had been drinking, had been binge drinking. 38% had had at least one drink in the past 30 days. So kids who had one drink have dropped from 38% down to 22%. Kids who have had 20 or five or more went from 26 down to 12%.
That's amazing, really.
It's
and,
huge.
And did you, in your reporting and when you were talking with both folks who are working in prevention and treatment, but also young people themselves, were there reasons that sort of percolated up as to why kids are moving away from drinking?
For me, that was a question I wish I'd asked more of youth or young people. I wish that was something that I was asking more, you know. You know, what we're able to get when we're talking with somebody one-on-one is an anecdotal perspective. So that might add context and clarity. But the YRBS data, it's the YRBS, and it took me a while to YRBS the way people in some of the agencies that deal with this data talk about it. What it's really good at is giving a larger collection. There might not be that much context. You might not be able to divine trends or know what's working. And, you know, I'm somebody that's very, very, very critical of these kinds of surveys and how they're put into high schools. Partly because I remember being a high schooler and not really understanding what these tests I was taking were for, kind of goofing off on some of them. And there's very inconsistent results from some place. That said, these are literally the tests that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, a lot of state agencies like the Department of Health and Social Services rely on. And they are very smart people who work really hard to make sure that they're using the best available data. And while it's far from perfect, this is the best available data. So I wish that was something that I was talking about. I can say the Department of Health and Social Services, the state's largest agency, is in the middle of a paradigm shift right now in terms of where they're putting focus. And it's a lot more towards preventative work. And we can talk about that later. I think that's a pretty huge thing. They've started to look not just at individual pathologies and individual problems and treating health in terms of people who are, you know, suffering from addiction after the fact. They've gotten much more savvy about looking at things at a community level. And in Alaska, that's actually a really good model because we have these kind of, I don't want to say isolated, but the community units are a lot more defined than in a lot of other places. So you can go to a place like Chicoloon, and you can go to a place like Homer and kind of have a sense of who you're working with and those populations. This is all still new and it's kind of developing in real time, but those are some of the things that I think do make a difference when you're looking at these downward trends. And then they're really focusing on perception, which Anne can probably talk about more.
Well, it seems like it's a little hard to believe that in a self-reported document that everyone would take that seriously. But it is interesting that the numbers have changed. They have gone down. And that does reflect, I believe, the overall trends with cigarettes and other substances that young people abused in much higher numbers than they are currently. So there does seem to be this trend toward healthier behavior, and it's not as cool as it used to be to drink and to smoke. Did you find that the kids that are still engaging in this behavior, are they getting into more trouble because of it? Is it the same amount of trouble, more intense focus? What have there been changes in that regard?
So a lot of the folks that I talk to, a lot of the young people I talk to, basically, I was actually talking about this with Madison and Kylie yesterday, two of the women I interviewed, and they were like, that's bunk. Kids are still drinking, kids are still using, they're just not telling you. And the thing is that that's because that's the world they were part of. They're trying to get out of it. But, you know.
So that's the world you see.
So that's the world they see.
Right.
You know, and even speaking with a young woman who's going through therapy, she's like, yeah, of course people are still drinking and doing drugs. It's so easy to get access to them. And that's because, yeah, when you're in that, it is really easy to get access to it. But here's the deal. Is that we're talking about this right now, right? We're talking about this number, 78% say they don't drink. And yeah, maybe that's not accurate. Like, maybe that's not, people aren't accurately self-reporting, but the fact is that now we're talking about it. And that's what a lot of the people who are working on this new campaign are trying to get out there. Like, this is a way to spark conversations and a way to spark getting people to say, okay, maybe I don't have to drink. I can still be cool and not drink because everyone else says they don't drink. So I can say I don't drink and not be the outsider.
And let me just say, you can certainly be cool and not drink. Take it from me. You can. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call. And we're going to go to the phones now and talk to Harry in Anchorage. Good morning.
Good morning. So I've been involved in this for a long time, and I'm really glad that you brought this forward this morning. It's a topic that we all can be affected, and many of us have been affected by it. A number of years ago, my wife was hit by a repeat offender, a drunk driver, and we worked on trying to prevent that sort of thing from happening again. It still happens way too often, but there are some 3,000 people in Alaska now that have a red stripe on their driver's license and their state ID if they don't have a driver's license anymore that prevents them from buying alcohol. And it's something that's becoming part of the society here, but it's still way underutilized, especially when you get outside of the municipality of Anchorage or Fairbanks. And I'm calling this morning really to ask people to put pressure on your legislators and on your assembly members and mayors and governors to utilize this tool more often to prevent this sort of thing from happening, rather than focusing just on punishment after the fact.
Well, thank you for those comments, Harry. And we are going to be talking about that approach, looking at prevention. And we could move into that now, I guess. There are some pretty significant numbers and kind of profound when you look at the comparisons of dollars into prevention versus dollars spent on treatment after the fact. And also, that doesn't even really look at the cost, the wider cost of emotional expense and damage to families and property, perhaps, or other crimes that people end up getting involved in before they get themselves in control. What are some of the numbers that you found about what it costs to put dollars into prevention versus dollars into treatment?
Well, I want to catch this and just say, you know, this is still kind of new stuff, being able to have a robust economical analysis of different approaches. I learned most of this, or I got most of my information on this, from the state's manager on prevention services, Ms. Diane Casto, who works for the Division of Behavioral Health, who was wonderful and one of the most excited state employees I think I've ever met. And her eyes just like lit up when she was talking about this stuff. But you know, on the low end, they can the state can say that they spend $9 per point of contact on preventative services. Now, like, let's get a grasp on that. That means, you know, at a health fair where maybe 200 people go through, you know, that's what they mean. $9 to talk to somebody, hand them a bag, hand them information, hand them supplies, stuff like that. You know, this is not revolutionary stuff. And I think that they would be the first to tell you this does not equal getting kids to not drink alcohol or not abuse substances. This is one approach of many. But on the other side, it costs around $50,000, $49,502. $50,000. to do intensive psychiatric care and evaluation for somebody suffering from a lot of the things that, you know, addiction fits into, whether it's psychosis, whether it's physical breakdown, whether it's just detox, you know, a lot of the more intense care things. It's $50,000. That's what the state spends on taking care of somebody to get them through. And that doesn't, you know, that doesn't couch all of the work that comes afterwards to help rebuild somebody's life.
Or the expense that somebody now pays for car insurance if they got picked up drunk driving.
No, or
any
what
of those other things.
What
that
a family went through,
into.
You know, seeking, you know, using private insurance to get private treatment.
Yes.
The court fees that are accrued when somebody's dealing with this. Like, this is like the very tip of the iceberg of the state can say, when somebody's dealing with acute addiction problems, here's what we know we're spending on top of everything else.
Let's go back to the phones. We're going to hear from Mike in Anchorage. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
You have a personal experience you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, I would. First, it's two parts. It's one is the veteran experience. I've worked with Wounded Warriors, and I'm a Vietnam veteran. The addiction relative to that experience is high, and I've watched the improvements in treatment over the years. The other side is family. I had the single parent, four children, because of the loss of a spouse through addictions, and it's been very, for me, it was just making up a decision. They've never seen alcohol in the home. I think there's a key component, is if your children are watching you drink on weekends and overindulge, and your behavior is going to be mirrored and mimicked. And I've seen that time and again. My purpose for this call is to remind folks that whether you're a parent or an uncle or an aunt, your kids are watching you. And that's, for me, was a key component. My children have never seen me except for my daughter's wedding, and I had a beer with my son for when he turned 21. I just don't do it with my – it's not a part of my life. And if you – can have that control or get that help, it'll be a major factor, in my opinion, for assisting children and not taking up those habits until they're 21 and they can make their own choices.
Well, thank you, Mike, for those comments, and I applaud your efforts as a parent, because we'll be talking about the role of parents, especially as it relates to juveniles and their behavior. But you brought up an important point. Children very often mirror what they see. If they see hitting in the home, if they see yelling, if they see substance abuse, that becomes normal. What's common becomes normal. And if that's what your experience is, that's what you think is normal behavior. Anne?
And Mike, I was wondering, you talk about different strategies you use for not using substances. Can you talk a little bit about what's worked for you?
Well, the cigarettes, I quit when they were 35 cents a pack out of the machine. And I used dental floss. Every time I had a cigarette pack placed in the car and in the home, I'd replace it with dental floss. And that worked for me. Alcohol was a difficult. It's an addiction from the family, generational. And I would remind folks, I'm older, and I watched the World War II veterans self-medicate, and the society accepted it. It wasn't when I was young, there were over 50,000 deaths a year from drunk driving, and there was no MAD, and there was no social stigma to being drunk. It was wasn't frowned upon. It was accepted. So I've seen the change culturally from what was and again, it's self-medication, dealing with the stresses of combat and the return back into society is just, unless you've been there, I can't express how difficult it is. And substances do help. I use alcohol to sleep.
You brought up an important point, Mike. That's been the story that I've heard from other veterans. My now deceased father-in-law was a World War II veteran, and he told his family that when they would come out of a particularly bad battle, they were just handed bottles of alcohol and told by their commander, here, forget about it now, and, you know, just get rid of the pressure this way. So
yeah, it's a pretty, that was the Vietnam, you know, get over it, quit weenie wine and don't cry about it. You know, it was very difficult returning to have the community turn against you. And then we started to isolate, and that's when we became, you know, the VFW didn't want us. The community wasn't too interested in us. There was a lot of rejection, and we became, you know, pretty antisocial. And then that turns into that camaraderie of alcohol. You can put on, I use the terminology of the warm blanket of alcohol. It makes you feel better. It lessens all those pains that you have, and it's very seductive.
But it's also very hollow. Thank you so much for your comments, Mike, and for sharing your personal experience with us. Zach, you wanted to add something quick before we go to a break?
Yeah, I mean, that was just, Mike, thank you so much for your call. You get that two things that we were finding in talking with a lot of researchers. One is modeling. You know, what you mentioned about kids watching their parents, and Laura, you picked that up as well. And there's a good deal of data, and I think that's pretty widely known that whether it's, you know, substance abuse, whether it's, you know, opening doors for people, kids kind of mirror what they learn to be as normal. And so that's really meaningful. And then very quickly, another thing that's a little bit more on the cutting edge research-wise is a lot of substantiation in terms of brain science about early exposure to alcohol, you know, young kids drinking, teenagers drinking, becoming, you know, kind of acclimating to partying and drinking regularly. It starts to change their brain. and that's something that, you know, may have anecdotally been there. And we're seeing a little bit more science and a little bit more research that's starting to substantiate that. And so one of the women we talked to was a professor who's worked on this topic a lot. She's at UAA's Justice Center, Professor Marnie Rivera. And she talked, I wish I'd been able to include more of all she said, because for me, it was just sitting there listening to, you know, a lot of stuff that in the social sciences or anecdotally or in activism, we hear a lot about, whether it's, you know, historical trauma or, you know, things of that nature. And, you know, it kind of makes sense to people that are familiar with it, that if you come from a family that's historically experienced trauma or been traumatized, that you're more likely to mirror some of those behaviors. And now there's more research coming out that says, like, yeah, we can see it in the brain.
You're
four times more likely to, develop a substance abuse problem if you start abusing substances before you're 18. When your brain is still developing, your frontal cortex is still malleable. A lot of the links between neurons, and I am far from a brain scientist, but even I could kind of like follow along and be like, yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah, but so there's a little bit more coming out about those linkages.
All right, we're talking about juvenile justice, young people, and substance abuse, and how we can help them see a better path and get on more solid ground. We'll be talking and taking your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking today, I'm Lori Townsend, and we're talking today about substance abuse and young people in Alaska. My guests today on TOA are Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes. They're both reporters for Alaska Public Media and KSKA. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255 statewide or locally in the Anchorage area. The number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. One of the stories or one of the threads that you followed was a young couple. And you worked with this young couple, Madison and Kylie. Tell us a little bit about them, and then we have an update.
So this actually goes directly into what our last caller, Mike, was saying. He was talking a lot about how influences with who you're living with and with your family can really impact whether or not you're using. And so the story with Madison and Kylie, and those aren't their real names, part of it is that Kylie grew up in a household where her father and her older siblings were all using meth, all of them. And so to get away from this, she met Madison, and together they've become this very insulated support system for one another. And so that was where I first met them, where they had left Anchorage to try to get away from using drugs, and they had been clean for a couple months. So that was about a month and a half ago, and I met up again with them yesterday. And now they're in a situation where they're still clean, which is great, but they don't have anywhere to live. Mm-hmm. So they're bouncing around from house to house. And when I was speaking with them yesterday, and I haven't heard an update yet this morning, they were actually going to go stay with Kylie's dad that night because they had nowhere else to go. So they knew that they were going back into a house where meth is pretty prevalent. So let's go into a cut where they're kind of, it starts out with Madison talking about how she feels about going back there.
I'm nervous just because, like, I mean, We know what they do, what they've been doing, and why not? But I think we'll be strong, you know.
Are you tempted to use meth again?
No. Like there are temptations sometimes, and sometimes it seems like it'd be easier just to go and do it. But there's a lot of reasons not to. And things have been a lot easier and better since we've been off. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, when I get like a craving, I just think like at first I'm like sometimes we'll be talking about it, we'll talk about the memories, and I'll be like, oh man, I really miss that feeling. But then I think about all the other feelings I felt other than just that one feeling of getting high, and I'm like, oh, I don't want all this stress. I don't want this or that. And
so she bought a big bag of Jolly Ranchers.
So I, like, every time I get a craving, I'm just like, I feel better now.
Yeah, they're... It's really fun watching them interact and talk about the ways that they're supporting each other. But again, it goes back to, if this is the environment you're in, it's going to influence if you're using substances. And they're so keenly aware of that, very keenly aware of that. And substance abuse is a larger issue. I think, Zach, can you talk a little bit about what you learned at DJJ from Nicole Charisma?
Yeah, I'm happy to. A big part of the story was reporting on a youth facility here in Anchorage, the McLaughlin Youth mm-hmm. Facility, just down the street from us, actually. And we were, you know, had, you know, wonderful officials from there showing us around and really excited to show off the work they do. And I know I said that before, but I've rarely in my reporting career, short as it is, encountered so many state officials with this much passion about their work. And, you know, Dennis Weston, the superintendent at McLaughlin, he and his team just really care about the work they do. And they gave us this long, like 3 or 4 hour tour, which we were exhausted by at the end. But it was really, you know, from the outside, it looks like this...
scary detention facility.
Yeah, just juvie. Juvie, you know, a place where bad kids get
razor
sent.
Razor wire on top of the walls.
And buried away and, you know, big heavy doors that seem to do nothing but creak and clank. And and getting to go in was really eye-opening and a really stark reminder that a lot of the time these are kids and they have these really capable employees who work at handling kids, many of whom come to them in the detention, which is, you know, if you can think of it, if you're more familiar from TV or from movies with the adult criminal system, it's kind of like it's like booking. Mm-hmm. And when kids get in trouble, they get sent there. If they have parole violations that they have to check in with, they go there. But a lot of the times when they're brought in, they're dealing with some really severe immediate trauma, long-term trauma, substance abuse issues, psychiatric issues. And a big part of what DJJ officials do when they get a new kid in is just figure out what is going on. And that can range from symptoms of withdrawal to super assaultive, combative concerns, all the way to we had one, you know, the superintendent, Dennis Weston, showed us a cell where there was a young man who was dealing with really severe health issues connected to sleep apnea and some problems sleeping. And he had a breathing machine next to his bed. And the treatment team had to figure out, okay, we have this kid who's not sleeping, and what are we going to do to make sure that he's rested? And that's just for kids in the first, you know, 24, 28 days that they're there. The detention is short term.
So they're sort of taking this, like, holistic look at everything, not just, hey, you're in trouble because you drank too much booze.
It's very much so.
Broader than that, which seems like you would have to treat all those layers, or you're just going to, the same problems will keep cropping up.
Yeah, and they're a very holistic approach to treatment. And if we could go to a cut from the warden of the, or the head of the girls' ward, one thing that I think is really important to mention is that even though not every kid comes in because of substance abuse related concerns, many kids who come in do have substance abuse issues. And so you'll hear Nicole kind of mention what of the girls' unit, how many of them are dealing with substance abuse.
It sucks because, like, we want to do all these things, like go to school.
Whoops. That wasn't exactly what we were looking for. Sorry.
That was Madison talking about
yeah,
how
that's okay.
Homelessness.
Let's go to the phones and take another caller right now. This is Matt. We're going to go to Matt in Juneau. Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
We're well. Did you have a comment?
I just retired after a 40-year career in addictions treatment and a lot of that in Alaska. And I would agree with your guest there that some of the data is not all that accurate and good. For example, the juvenile justice data really is dependent a lot on the police force recognizing alcohol involved in a lot of crimes, or the police forces that put an emphasis on minor consuming or other alcohol-related crimes, and that'll raise the data or lower it. And the YRBS, like you said, is self-reporting. And by the way, it only reports kids in school. a lot of the kids that have substance abuse problems or have dropped out of school and are in another world themselves. And then I don't know if your guest looked at Monitoring the Future. It's another national study that includes Alaska a lot of times. And it's a good to check that data against the YRBS data as well. But one of my things that I would really like to bring forth into your show would be that after 40 years of working in addiction, one of the things that we ignore and misstate is probably one of the biggest reasons why we drink so much up here is policy. We have a tremendous amount of availability of liquor because we have and so many licenses per capita and so many stores that sell, I'll say illegally after hours and to young people. And we also have, when you have availability like that, when you have access like that, you have availability. And when you have availability, you have a lot more drinking, and that's with adults as well as youth. And so a lot of the problems we have are historical in terms of a policy. We were a federal jurisdiction when prohibition was repealed, and the federal government did a terrible, terrible job of monitoring alcohol abuse and alcoholism. And when we became a state, we made the problem even worse by setting up a alcohol beverage control board that was basically controlled by the industry, still is. Two of the five members of the alcohol control board are liquor industry representatives. A lot of the lobbying here in Juneau on alcohol issues are funded by the wholesalers out of Seattle. So we have a policy, a legislative system that favors that business and always has, and it results in so much availability and access that you're going to always have a problem until that changes. It's not a nice thing to talk about. People hate politics and alcohol in terms of prevention, but every prevention person will tell you that we'll probably make more progress in lowering the per capita consumption, which is one of the highest in the United States, of alcoholic beverages by doing some decent updating on our policies.
Well, thank you, Matt. You've raised some very interesting issues. Did the two of you delve into any of the issues that he's talked about here as far as the policy implications and how that may either work against or for substance abuse?
Yeah, not these particular ones. And Matt, thank you for your call. One of the things that I can say DHSS, or the Division of Behavioral Health, looks at now is the prevalence of alcohol, selling establishments, whether that's package stores, bars and restaurants, stuff like that, in communities to begin evaluating, okay, what are we working with? So there is a little bit more developing state policy or state considerations or metrics for evaluating health that look at how many establishments are there. I do want to just push back and say, what that analysis doesn't quite get at, or where it doesn't get at, is rates of abuse in the bush. Dry communities, damp communities, they certainly do not have, stores that are package stores that are selling off or multiple restaurants that are selling off. And so it is a problem, but I would couch it and say that's very much, to me, a South Central or a rail belt problem or Southeast, just kind of the more developed parts of the state. But one of the things that Matt mentioned was MCAs. And where police statistics and crime statistics kind of dovetail with where DJJ gets its data and what they know to be working. And MCA rates have fallen dramatically in the last 4 years.
And you should explain MCA is minor consuming alcohol.
Forgive me, I've gotten ahead of myself. Right. I'm getting weighed down in the jargon. I get very passionate about data analytics and social scientific methods. MCAs are minor consuming alcohol. It's written into the alcohol codes, and it's what happens, if an 18-year-old gets... it's a status offense. When an 18-year-old gets found to be drinking, they get this citation and it gets entered in court view and they have to show up. And there's a big push right now, actually, out of the ABC board, which Matt was criticizing for being, kind of industry centric. But right now, the head of the ABC board, Cynthia Franklin, cares very deeply and passionately about reforming the MCA listing within Title IV and making it a ticketable offense. And we there's other people that have been working on this. There was a Senate bill that didn't get very far, Senate Bill 99, this session. But the whole idea is that you make it easier for cops to intervene, for police to intervene, for them to issue a ticket, like a parking ticket or a speeding ticket, something that doesn't make you have to, you know, get entered into court view. It doesn't stay with you for the rest of your life. And it's a little bit easier to sort out, but it's a red flag. It's a data point. It's an easier data point. And a lot of the time, the reason we've seen MCA, minor consuming alcohol citations, fall so dramatically in 4 years is a staffing issue. At least in Anchorage, I don't want to speak for the whole state, but in Anchorage, they declined by 83% in 4 years. That's huge. And it has nothing to do with whether or not kids are drinking less. It's just because police are responding to house parties and noise complaints less often. And those are the most common point of citation for MCAs. So, you know, Matt is right. The data is only as good as the policies to collect it. And for, you know, the whole reason we called this series The Blind Spot was because when it comes to youth abusing alcohol, we really don't have policies and procedures that capably, you know, catch this.
Let's go back to the phones. Excuse me. Let's go back to the phones. We're going to hear now from Dash in Anchorage. Good morning.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Did you have a question or a comment?
Well, yeah. It doesn't strike me that you guys are a temperance movement, but you're not addressing, I guess, a lot of it is you seem to see alcohol and drug use, period, not abuse, as a problem. And that's fine. That's absolutely okay. But my, I guess, question is, we as a culture send this ridiculously mixed message. Alcohol and drug use are bad. Don't smoke cigarettes until you're 19. Then it's okay. Or until you're 21. Then it's okay. And what's happening is you've got these groups of people that aren't exposed to it. And in my personal experience, like it, this is not empirical, it's anecdotal, but the people that I saw when I went to college who had never drank before lost their minds. They were the people that were doing things like diet, you know, passing out and aspirating their own vomit, things like that. And so you've got this culture where it's, we don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot like a lot of other issues. We just don't want to talk about it because it's kind of uncomfortable. And then we cut you loose into the world and you're on your own. And alcohol, when used properly, is not harmful or dangerous, but it's really easy to use it improperly. And the way that you learn that, as you guys said, is through exposure, you know, a proper environment and your parents and all that jazz. But we don't deal with that. First, we learn how to drive a car and we do things like that. And, you know, the previous guy said there are, no, actually, someone in your program said that your minor consumption tickets are down because the cops don't have the time to respond to house parties. And my thought is, wait a minute, you've got a bunch of teenagers consuming alcohol without driving in a central environment where they're not really affecting anyone, and that's what we want to crack down on?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Well, you know, you've raised an interesting point, Dash, about this sort of the forbidden fruit aspect of substances where people are told you can't have it until you reach a magical age and then you can. And so I think Dash has raised some interesting points about people not having any exposure and maybe a little too much parental rigidness in some respects, and then they get released to college and they don't know how to control themselves. So there's got to be some kind of a happy medium in there somewhere, but I don't think the answer is when you're 14, mom and dad should introduce you to alcohol. I don't think that that's what we want to look at. But I think it's important to have those conversations with young people about what you will be exposed to and how to deal with those things. Anne?
Well, I think that's part of, and Dash, thank you for calling in. Because I think that's part of what people are trying to do now, especially with like changing this whole campaign for the positive social norms, is the whole idea is that youth want to be able to talk about alcohol and to talk about substances with their parents, with trusted adults. Because in fact, in the research that they're doing for the positive social norms campaign, that's what youth are saying. We want to talk about it because Dash, you're completely right. Like, I've seen it myself in my own experience. You're completely cut off. And then you're in a wide world and you're like, woohoo, let's go. So the whole idea is that what needs to happen now is in order for people to form a healthy relationship with substances, because it is very possible, and research with adults and with youth shows it's very possible, is to talk about it, you know, and to not, I don't think any of us are advocating for complete temperance and for completely cutting it off. But you're right. I mean, how do we start that conversation in a healthy way?
Zach, did you want to add something really quickly?
Yeah, I just want to say, Dash, I share a lot of your concerns. And I think the later we got into the series, the more I personally felt like, oh, man, we're not establishing gradients. You know, we've not, or I've not done a good enough job of saying, you know, what's the difference between experimentation or kind of, you know, healthy modeling, healthy acculturation, and, you know, responsible socialization into the kind of alcohol consumption that we as a state, we as a nation, we as a culture have decided is permissible. And then when are you getting sent to the Division of Juvenile Justice for your third MCA? And so I apologize that it wasn't more fleshed out. And we agree, we are not kind of advocates for total, you know, temperance or, you know.
Well, we're not advocates at all. We're,
no, not
we're reporting on what's going on. And we're also going to take a short break, and we will talk about what's new and what's hopeful coming out of some of what you learned during the reporting on The Blind Spot when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about youth and substance abuse. We're going to go back to the phones and take a call now from Nancy in Dillingham. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Do you have a comment?
Yes, I do. I'm a young elder. I'm just going to talk from my experience. I left my village in the 70s to go to high school, and that's where I started trying alcohol. So, and that really, it's a real, when you're around, you get influenced, get peer pressure. So the environment that you're in really does impact your life. And with me, it didn't really start till after I got married. And then I start being, you know, I became an alcoholic.
Did you have alcohol in your home when you were a child? Did your parents have alcohol in the home?
Not they didn't have that until later on in my life. I left my home when I was 13, 14 years old to go high school.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents drank later on in my life. But the most influence I had was when I went to high school.
I think that Nancy, for that. You've raised some interesting points about that exposure and what happens, and that's something that Dash was talking about, and also the other caller who joined us earlier and was talking about how he had to raise his four kids alone because his wife was abusing substances and was out of the family. But he also mentioned that he had a drink at his daughter's wedding, I think he said, and also when his son turned 21. So he was reflecting a way of interacting with substances that gave the reality to his children that, okay, you don't, you know, maybe abstinence isn't the only path, that you can be responsible in your use.
And to add to that, and again, thank you, Nancy, for letting us know that, you know, sometimes exposure outside of the home and peers
Absolutely.
Really does influence how you act. And I think that that happened for you. You mentioned also when you were an adult and with your husband, you started drinking more too. I think, so I'm actually going to reference an article written by Gabrielle Glasser, who in The Atlantic, that came out a couple months ago, called The Irrationality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that article, she talks a lot about exactly what multiple callers have brought up, is that there's going to be alcohol around you and that you don't have to give it up 100% to be successful and to recover from being an alcoholic. And she talks a lot in the article about how going cold turkey isn't necessarily the most effective way. And that's what research is starting to show. And so just what was mentioned earlier, the have one drink in this social situation, but be conscious of it and be conscious of how that changes your behavior. And so give up the unhealthy aspects of it, but still be able to healthily interact with different substances.
And I think that, you know, to be fair, abstinence has clearly worked for some folks.
For some people, definitely.
They just realize, why risk it?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, just stay away from it completely and not worry about, I mean, there's plenty of other ways to have a great time without having to involve any kind of substance at all.
Oh, definitely.
So we only have 1 minute left. Let's talk very quickly about what you learned about what's working for young people now.
What's working, it's different for every single person, and it's always going to be. For Kylie and Madison, it's getting themselves out of the situation. It's separating themselves from the families and the people who are using the substances. Other people, treatment programs do work, like setting boundaries, setting rules, understanding who you are, and using that strength in yourself, actually for everyone I've spoken to, and I think Zach as well, finding the strength in yourself really is how you learn to have healthy interactions with each other and with substances.
I'm a little bit less optimistic than Anne about a lot of the time. And I think my interest was really in where institutions putting in structures to, better respond to things as they really are, rather than this kind of optimistic, here's how we hope it is down the road. And so for me, seeing that there are meaningful policy reforms that the ABC board is heading up, that the Division of Behavioral Health is heading up, a lot more insistence on collaboration between nonprofits and agencies that are working on this on the ground, and a lot more grant funding for collaborative programs that go to teens on their own terms, you know, rather than starting it through schools.
Thank you to my guests, Anne Hillman and Zachariah Hughes, KSKA reporters. You can learn more about their series and see all of the stories at alaskapublic.org. Look for The Blind Spot, and there are a lot of resources there. Thank you to our engineer, Ron Zastro, Josh Edge on the phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on Condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.